Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
So today's guest is a first-time speaker in RFRX. We haven't had him yet. His name is David Teachout. And just as a brief bio, David grew up in Michigan, which apparently is the home of taking the first day of hunting season off from school. Fun fact, didn't know that. And went to a Bible college in his then quest to become a minister for Christianity. Pushes ensued, answers were not forthcoming, and the result was a life of studying humanity from a place of curiosity rather than condemnation. Right now, David resides in the Seattle area with a career almost entirely focused on psychology, and he possesses a sometimes frustrating desire to pursue complicated conversations. Thank you so much for being here today, and welcome.
Thank you. I'd actually forgotten a little bit of what I wrote in that intro, and every time I hear about Michigan, it always makes me laugh. It's no joke. It really is. It's hunting is huge there, and you can take a day off from school and nobody bats an eye. It's just very amusing.
It's a silly question. How many days can you take off going hunting from school?
Usually it ended up being a few. Given I grew up in the time which there was a story in which a woman was shot by a hunter while getting her mail. And the story goes that he thought she was a really large bunny because she had white furry gloves on and thought, well, that's the tail of a rabbit, right? Yeah, no. Michigan. Good times.
Wow.
Yes. Seeing Shannon in the chat. Yes. Michigan is a, yeah. Well, and I went to Bible college in Grand Rapids, which I affectionately refer to as the buckle on the Bible belt. I think last time I knew, there's only like two other cities in the entire continental U.S. that have more churches per square block or something than Grand Rapids. I mean, it's intense. It's, and part of it is because they've got like four religious universities there. So, it's, yeah, pretty crazy.
It's like a fun place. The first place I'll visit when I go to the U.S.
Michigan, it has some lovely places. I prefer the mountains out here on the West Coast. So, not going anywhere.
Yeah, I was in lived in Springfield, Missouri for quite a while, and we played a game, see if we can get like from one end of the city to the other without passing a church. And nobody ever won that. Nobody.
Nobody can ever do that.
No.
When I lived there, they still had an ordinance in which you could not buy hard alcohol on Sundays. I think that's really changed in like the 15 years I've been out here. But yeah, back when I was there, yeah. So of course everybody bought it Saturday night. It was like a major free for all for purchasing. But
yeah, I was gonna say, how else can you survive church on Sunday if you don't have that hard alcohol and, you know, vodka, whiskey, whatever you guys drink in the U.S.?
Well, given the fact that at the time I was probably the one street preaching against alcohol and any other kind of sinful behavior, I didn't have much of a problem with it. But
How did you kind of get? What was your deconversion process like?
It was interesting. You know, deconverting as a student in a Bible college is fun. there was actually a group of us, and that we had really started delving into philosophy, and I had looked up this book. It's actually by George H. Smith, Atheism, the Case Against God. And I'd seen it on a shelf, and a person basically went, no, take a year, study some more presuppositionalism, among other things, and then you can take a look at it. During that year, I became convinced of science and evolution, which then became very difficult to hold a literal translation of Genesis. And then got hold of the book again, and like 50 pages in, I'm like, I'm out. Okay, now what? I'm 2 years into this program and I've now taken like a half dozen theology courses. What am I going to do? I did end up finishing the program. I just switched to psych. And so basically kind of double major focused on psychology and theology. And not least because, quite frankly, it was a little bit out of spite. Because they didn't ever want to have somebody later on go, if you'd only stayed, you would have had your answers given to you. So now I can say that I graduated with honors, and no, I did not find the answers there. So it was a lot of fun. But there was a whole group of us that went through a process, and I think about five of us actually deconverted. It was, honestly, it's probably some of the best memories I have. It was emotionally difficult, no joke about that. But it was also just an incredible time of discovery, which from what I hear is what college is supposed to be about.
Right.
So it was good. Yeah.
Yeah. So today's topic is identity, obviously, and I guess how we can move on from religious identity, because obviously when you're in an organized religion, that religion is a massive, massive part of your identity, if not the defining factor. So,
and, you know, so identity is definitely going to be something we'll touch on. And a lot of this has to do with, I mean, I don't know if anybody else in the room, anybody who might be listening later, religion is more than just something that any of us have likely just believed. You know, it wasn't something that we, you know, to varying degrees, it wasn't like a set of clothing that we took on and off. It was the means by which we determine meaning and purpose and direction. I mean, when I left, it wasn't just, oh, well, now I get to go somewhere else. It was, what's the point? Like, what is the point to any of this? What, you know, fundamentally relationship with others, relationship to values, which is what we're going to start off with, relationship to, you know, sense of who I am, sexuality, community development. I mean, literally everything, the reason for getting up in the morning can be, I mean, it's kind of pulled out from under you. And so, you know, anytime that I talk with anybody through this process, it's something that, you know, I try to keep in mind, because I never want to think of this as, and I'll be the first one to joke around about various religious beliefs and my own journey and so on, but none of it's supposed to be meant as flippant, because it really is serious. And I take very seriously anybody who holds to literally any belief, because it's a big deal. And so getting into the values thing, what has happened since then is a kind of rewrite of how, I find meaning at all, what it actually matters to me. And there was a difficulty, of course, because when it comes to what matters, or what I'm referring to as values here, for the longest time, it's kind of given. The names are given, you know, hence the first polling question. You know, it was like, what were these values that were so important to you? And further, not only were the values given to you, but the definition of them was. Particular behaviors were circumscribed. They were told, like, here's how it is to be this way. And, you know, you can, you know, the whole thing of, you know, by their fruits, you'll know them. You know, this is, it was an understanding that you could look at what somebody did and backtrack it to an acknowledgement of what they cared about. And therefore, you knew, we're together. We belong with one another. And there was some great coherence there. There was some great peace and consistency. And so part of the process then here is kind of looking at, okay, well, one, what are our values? Where do we get them? You know, is now that we've, you know, left or in the process of leaving a kind of authoritarian structure, you know, is it now going to be family? Is it going to be school? Is it going to be society at large? Do we even think about these things? Don't have to. But if anybody's going to be, you know, living a more reflective life, and for those of us who have left in more than just a peak of anger, we did some reflection. So our life isn't going to, we didn't stop asking questions once we've left. If anything, we probably have more questions now than we did before, because the sky's the limit. Heck, for that matter, sky isn't even the limit. Literally, space, I mean, like every, there is no limit to what we can actually ask now, which for the first few years, you know, I have to, you know, be honest with myself. Had I encountered a group of believers that actually allowed me to pursue as many questions as I wanted, odds are the process of leaving would have taken a very different route. I mean, it probably would have ended up the same way. Yeah, I mean, it probably would have ended up the same way eventually, but it certainly would have been different. It would have probably taken longer, because one of the reasons of leaving was going, no, this is, here's the questions that you're allowed to ask, and then these are the ones that you're not allowed to ask. And, you know, which is fundamentally the whole story of Job. I mean, as someone who actually preached on, gave a couple of sermons on Job, you know, back in the day, you know, there's one way of looking at it, but frankly, I always looked at it as Job could do anything except question the authoritarian structure of God, period. Anything else was open. He could question his humanity. He could question his family. He could question his own goodness. But as soon as he questioned the authority structure, boom, plague. Like, you are, here's where I got to step in and tell you to shut up. And of course, I'm sitting there having a predilection of being anti-authoritarian and not really appreciating being told, you know, what I am and what I'm not allowed to, you know, ask. But of course, now the question ends up being left open of going, wait a minute. So now that I no longer have this ready-made structure, what the hell am I supposed to do with myself? How do I have morality? How do I have, you know, any of this? And this is not just some, you know, philosophical, like, you know, diatribe against atheism or anything, where it's like, well, now you don't have God, how can you ever be moral? No, but it is a question, because now, instead of having it being provided, we have to make it up ourselves. And so in some fashion. And so I'm going to share a image real quick. I don't want to keep it up very long, because like being able to see everybody and what's going on. And for anybody who wants these images or something, you can actually contact me anytime and I'll provide them. You can find them on my website as well. Amaya, I'll send them to her as well, and can be, you know, set up. But I'm a real big believer in resources. I love just giving stuff out, having conversations. So this is actually a stretch work under for not only my therapeutic practice, but a lot of what I teach in, like, you know, coaching and just psychoeducation. But the idea here is that we have this process that we have our values, which are essentially a kind of cognitive shorthand for what we care about. And another way of looking at them is being triggered. And I don't mean triggered in the kind of snowflake way. I mean triggered in the sense of, anytime we feel an emotional reaction, It's because something bumped up against either something that is really important to us that was either supported, like being given a hug by somebody we love, or it's been violated, i.e. when we were lied to, or otherwise, you know, called names, or were, you know, attacked for whatever reason. It's like something's been violated. Well, what is that? Well, that's something we care about. Now, we move through that and we go, okay, wait a minute. What do these things mean for me? And part of that is if I were to tell anybody, for instance, good family values, or the group, you know, the Family Research Council, you'd probably have an immediate, you know, recoil and go, wait a minute, no, not really big on that. At the same time, I don't think any of us here probably stopped caring about family, honesty, integrity, truth, you know, intimacy, the power of relationship, any of these things. We didn't stop caring about these things, but we sure define them a little differently. We look at them differently through a different lens now that we're constantly developing, one that hasn't been handed to us. And the whole purpose behind that then is that the way that we see what we care about informs and gives the structure for what we then do, how we respond to things. So any time that we are doing something, one way of looking at behavior, whether or not it's ours or somebody else's, is literally every behavior is to support something, a value that we care about. Either to show that this is the way we thank you for supporting in the same way I do, or in trying to showcase how we would like it to be supported. Part of what we're then going through here is kind of going, okay, well then how does, you know, this work in practice? You know, this, because let's face it, this is not actually a typical way that we talk about values. I can think of immediately, like, what was the big thing, you know, when the war on terror started and George W. Bush came up, was like, they don't really care about our values. Well, that always kind of jarred me a bit. And on the opposite, like, well, here's a candidate that cares about family values again. Well, wait a minute. Different groups don't have the final say on what these things mean. You know, just because I say that I belong to the group of family values does not mean that other people can't hold them. We just have to have a conversation about what they mean to one another. I mean, for that matter, even the people that we're supposedly fighting, quite often, I mean, I will fundamentally disagree with the behavior and their worldview, but to say somebody who's willing to sacrifice themselves for something that they believe in is lacking in integrity or honesty or doesn't care about their family, I mean, I don't know how anybody else out there who's willing, like, how often are any of the people we know willing to sacrifice themselves for that? Mm-hmm. Now, we can still fundamentally disagree there. It's totally fine. But how we go about it is not a matter of these values are mine and those are yours. It's now more of a question of how do we relate to one another in this, you know, in the world? And that's part of the process then of developing this identity, you know, post leaving, you know, our faith. And so wanted to actually quote, well, actually there will be a list of some, you know, books, again, resources. I swear in another life, I was a librarian. So really big on providing as many literature as possible. Like, hey, read this, read that. My Kindle library is filled with a few hundred books that I probably haven't read yet, but really plan on. So it will happen eventually. I will get to them. But there's something from Mark Johnson. He wrote Morality for Humans, subtitled Ethical Understanding from the Perspective of Cognitive Science. Highly recommend reading this. Just a fantastic way of exploring naturalistic ethics. But he wrote, you know, moral deliberation at its best is a process of reconstructing our experience in a way that resolves the morally problematic situation that is currently confronting us. Okay, makes sense. Such a process involves the only reasonable notion of transcendence available to humans, namely the ability to move beyond our current habits of thought and action to creatively remake some aspect of ourselves and our world. Like, that's what we're all in the process of doing, having left our faith. We're remaking ourselves in some fashion. We're just trying to figure out a way to do so. And see, and he goes further on to go, there is nothing about such a process that takes us out of our skins, as if we were somehow little gods capable of generating moral absolutes. Instead, imaginative moral deliberation is embedded, so socially embedded, embodied, so in these meat suits that we all have, and enacted within our changing, malleable experience. So that was a mouthful a bit, but fundamentally what it boils down to is kind of more of a more academic way of describing really what I just, you know, showed in the image, is that we are engaged in this changing dynamic of figuring out, how do I relate to myself? How do I relate to others? And how do I do it in a way that's frankly consistent and makes sense of my experience? I will say, I will never be asked to come on Oprah because I don't have ready-made answers for all these things. And I also think you probably have a greater sense of morality, but I won't go on my Oprah diatribe. And so the issue here being is that, wait a minute, what then does this mean? How do we go about doing this? And part of this then, now that we've kind of looked at values, we're looking at this narrative or worldview idea. There's a big difference between an ideology that comes from an authority and one that is personally, consciously developed. And that felt feeling, that difference, is really a sense of ownership, a sense of responsibility, a sense of disconnect. Some people might know where I'm going. Like, fundamentally, any time that an ideology is given to somebody via an authority figure or structure, there will always be a sense of disconnection going on between themselves and what is actually happening, which is where sin comes in. No joke. Like, we're, you know, to kind of paraphrase Eric Fromm, you know, he's like, humankind is about the only creature that ever questions their purpose in life. You know, the cheetah doesn't ask, should I actually stalk and hunt this antelope? It just does its thing. Beavers create dams. Not much thinking through that. They just go through the process. People are really the only one that goes, I don't belong. There's something weird going on. You know, there's nature and then there's me and not sure what, which frankly is why authority draws us in, because it helps us answer that. But it draws us in, of course, by perpetuating and feeding on that disconnect. So it's almost like a, almost, it practically is. It's like a socially made drug. Like, the more, and you get a Bible and you get a Bible. Absolutely. Like, there's this idea that the more you feed into this, the more, like, there's this promise on the outside. There's a promise at the end of the road that eventually you're going to feel connection. You're going to feel great. Even as the actual ideology, the worldview, the way that you're thinking about yourself is to perpetuate the notion of disconnection and a kind of unfeeling for yourself, which ultimately is actually one of the reasons why, you know, amongst many, that I ended up leaving fundamentalism entirely. Not just fundamentalist religion, but fundamentalism of any variety, political, social, doesn't matter, is because at a level of the of a fundamentalist psychology is a deep-seated disconnection between who we are, who we feel about ourselves, and who we feel about our fellow people. And I just don't want that, to be perfectly honest. Like, that's just not, you know, I think I'm reminded of, was it Bertrand Russell, who was like, said something along the lines of like, there's two things that fundamentally drive me. And one being a search for truth, and two was a deep-seated empathy for the suffering of others. Something like that. My paraphrase, so don't quote me. but it was you probably said it a whole lot more, you know, quotable than I just made it. But that was fundamentally what it was. And it, you know, it came, there was one of the things that it came across and going, you're right. Like, this is just fundamentally. So why would I want to be a part of something that at bone marrow deep is all about separating me from me and me from others? So, but of course, here's the trick about a worldview is that, you know, it determines what is to be considered as facts. You know, in this day and age of internet echo chambers and conspiracy theories, you know, the idea of, well, you know, what's the phrase that I've often used to use, don't anymore, but used to use of like, well, you can have your opinion, but you can't have your own facts. Well, from a certain perspective, facts don't exist in a bubble. They're not just these free floating things that we kind of snatch out of the air and go, ah, oh, here's a fact, here it is. Facts have a structure. They have a way of connecting. And the way that we, oh my, former diehard QAnon fan. Yeah, you'd have a good conversation with my mother. But, you know, the thing here being is that facts exist within a certain structure, and that structure is a worldview. So when we look at things, we're literally being able to go, oh, this fact connects to this one, and then this goes to here, and now it makes a triangle, or now it makes a square, or whatever we want. And to do that, it provides then, you know, a sense of direction. It allows us to go, what am I supposed to pay attention to? Hence one of the polling questions about what mattered to you when you were a believer, what has changed since then? You know, what personal resources should I be giving in this whole process? It provides, you know, a structure for determining, frankly, whether the world is safe, i.e. right, because as soon as we think of things as being right, it's rather safe knowing that, or uncertain, i.e. wrong. And then, of course, lastly, it creates a sense of community. This is why, you know, I love the whole, you know, opening part here, talking with, you know, Eric and Amaya and all the sense of community that is being built, because that is fundamentally what we end up losing. It's not just that sense of direction, it's that sense of interconnection. And from another, again, book, again, see, librarian, it's what it used to be, is from Peter Block's book, Community. And he discusses this idea of being belonging. And he looks at it as having two different meanings. You know, first is that you have a sense of being related to and a part of something. It's membership. You know, the experience of being at home in the broadest sense of the phrase. Belonging is best created when we join with other people in producing something that makes a place better. And secondly, it has to do with being an owner. Something belongs to me. So when we're constructing a worldview, this is why one constantly continue to ask a ton of questions, try to be as humble as possible, to varying degrees of success, to be perfectly honest, and to really sit there and kind of go, I have the feeling of thinking that I knew everything, that I had the source of all truth. I don't ever want to get back into that feeling before again, because again, fundamentalism, there's always a question of being wrong, either in part or in whole. And living that way is part of this whole processing, you know, creating that worldview. But that's where the whole sense of ownership of these things come in. And so one way of looking then at narrative is that it's a kind of, this is a broad term, holds both perspective, structure, and intentionality. So it allows us to make sense of the world and provides a direction on how we want to act within it. A whole lot more to it, but I won't geek out anymore about that. And so we then come into like, okay, well, so now I know what I care about. It's still quite possible to care about the same things that I did even as a believer. It's just that obviously the way that I care about them, how they look in practice, is obviously going to be a little different. Financial security is still something that, particularly for, you know, starving college students, is obviously still something that is really important. But you're not going to act on financial security by tithing to a church.
One of the parables that kind of irritates me the most was that old, the parable about the old lady giving like two pennies and the rich man kind of giving it like a lot, but it was hardly a dent in his his coffers, in a sense. That is the one that irritates me the most, or one of them that irritates me the most, kind of along those lines.
Absolutely. Well, and that's where to say, and that's really what a lot of any kind of fundamentalist ideology wants us to do, is they want to hold on to that it's not just behavior, it's meaning that they want to hold on. They want to be able to say, we own this value and we get to decide what behavior belongs in this circle of that value. And so we can look and go, nope, what you did over there was awful because it wasn't in our little circumspect gated community of this value. You know, this is why it's so freeing and also can be extremely disconcerting once we've left fundamentalism behind. And it's because we suddenly are open with this idea of, wait, I can give the two pennies or I can give $1 million. Like, nobody's telling me what to do. Nobody's telling me, like, literally, I could do either one, and it's up to me to say what meaning was a part of it, why I did it, give a justification, and use it as means of building the community around that action. Well, that's a lot of responsibility, to be perfectly honest, which can be a little bit anxiety provoking. So, you know, there are still, I officially deconverted November of 2001. All sense of honesty, there are still nights, there's still days in which I get that sense of, oh shit, this is all on me. Okay, what am I supposed to do with this?
There's a sense of both like incredible freedom, it's all me. But then there's also this sense of like, but it's all me and I could totally fuck it up. Immediately I saw the two sides of that same coin. It was really both freeing and frightening, I think.
I totally normalized that. Like that is a completely natural, understandable process of going through all of this. This is my inner therapist coming out. But you know, it really is. Like, it's easy to then take that sense of anxiety, that sense of uncertainty, and turn it back on ourselves and go, oh, I made a mistake, or perpetuate the idea that there's something wrong with us. And instead, we just kind of secularize it. You know, instead of sin, now it's mental illness. I almost don't want to say that because it's not the same thing. So don't leap on me about that. But that's a whole other conversation. But it is, it's an easy way of then looking at like, oh, there's something still fundamentally wrong about not even who I am, but what I am. Mm. And no, there isn't. you're just human like the rest of us and trying to
I think that's one of the worst things about religion is this idea that we are all wrong, that we're all sinful, that we're dirty and that we need to be saved. Like that is such an awful concept. I don't understand why religion had to have that. I mean, obviously, I guess it's because this feeling of controlling someone, because obviously if they think that they need to be saved, then they're more likely to look for help. But this is such an awful thing. And I feel like in the chat, there's been a couple of comments about children. And I just think that if you're a child and they're telling you that, that must be such a traumatic experience to grow up with, to think that you are just sinful. Mm-hmm.
Well, and we see that quite often in groups. You know, we talk about ideological purity testing. You know, it's like if you dare to question some sacrosanct idea, well, now you're no longer a Republican, you're no longer a Democrat. You know, it's this, everybody's walking around in this straight up, like, no true Scotsman fallacy. You know, it's just, it's utterly absurd about, you know, if you don't believe this, then you're no longer. It's like, really? Who picked you as the final arbiter of what is and isn't belonging to this idea? You know, the what's going on quite often now of like, you know, ideas should be, you know, denied, that we need to hide ourselves from certain things. All that is a secularized version of religious fundamentalism. It's really all this boils down to. And the reason we need to hide ourselves from it is because there's some kind of fundamental wrongness in you based on, again, an immutable characteristic of skin color or race or whatever have you. And it's like, no, you know, whether or not you move it from humanity writ large or whether or not you put it in some kind of characteristics, the same process still applies. There's something wrong with you that you had no choice in the matter. And now you have to, you know, continue to walk through this process of constant, you know, self-flagellation. And it's like, no, humanity contains all of it. Thank you. The good, the bad, the indifferent, and everything in between. And that's part of this whole process then, is like we have, you know, these things that we care about. We have this structure of what we're trying to figure out how this works. And then we're then trying to engage in the best way that we can with the behavior that we have. And so part of...
I was kind of born into this family that believed in the religion, and you know, grew up being told I was broken, and so it's very hard to imagine a world or like what I would be or what a person could be who wasn't born into that, wasn't growing up kind of told that they were broken at birth, and had to be constantly redeeming, and they'll never get to this this idealized state. They'll always fall short. So it's kind of like something that many of us have to struggle with, just as a very basic part. Like how do we kind of get over that? And it affects our values so much too, going forward. Something we have to work on.
Right. This that sense of again, coming back to that sense of disconnect. You know, it's why, I mean, I don't know if anybody else out there has noticed, but I at least have noticed that there is a fair number of, you know, non-believers who then fall into other extremist, you know, often political ideologies. You know, there's, and it happens, and I used to, you know, Yeah, okay. To be perfectly honest, still do my fair judgment about it. I just try to curb the judgment eventually.
don't be a secular asshole, David.
Exactly, yeah. But part of it is that there is that still felt feeling of going, there's a sense of continuity. Like, I can get rid of God, but there's still that feeling of uncertainty can be debilitating. It can be quite awful. Yeah. Awful. And when you then are given yet another structure where you don't have to, you know, prostrate yourself in some sense of obeisance before an immaterial, you know, deity, now you can do something right in front of you, and then it starts making sense of the world. It's like, oh yeah, okay, sign me up. It's nothing wrong. It's just, again, being human. We really, really, really don't like uncertainty. We will literally continue awful, awful habits. We will continue getting engaged with awful people and poor relationship choices because, forgive the quote, but better the devil you know. We love consistency. And if we can create this even out of awful behaviors, we will freaking do it.
Welcome. That's an excellent point. Yeah. But on the flip side too, living in a world where there isn't any supernatural being that can change their mind on a whim, like based on somebody's supplication to them or something like that, can totally change their mind. Living in a world that is like run completely by physical processes. Obviously, the human interactions are not necessarily driven that way purely, but just the physical world being dictated by rules that we're beginning to understand more and more. It kind of feels a little more comforting. Like I'm not going to get struck down because someone on the other side of the country prayed for me for something bad to happen to me or something like that.
Most definitely. And there, you know, it was, you know, so I'm a avid reader, and I love fiction. I love fantasy. So, I mean, as starting off with, Lord of the Rings in like the third grade, it was just like, put me in front of a fantasy novel. You're going to lose me for a few hours. And
nerd.
I love it. part of, you know, this thing is like, you know, anybody who reads this, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if magic existed? And, you know, and a friend long ago who, you know, kind of poked that bunny and noted that going, but magic doesn't really make any sense. Like, once you get past the cool factor, and you start going down the path of like, wait a minute, there is then a fundamental part of my experience that makes no rational sense and cannot make any rational sense. It will always be apart from me. That's really disconcerting. Which is really what a supernatural sense gives you. And so and that's where that flip side comes, like you're describing. Getting rid of that, even if, and this is a whole broader conversation about whether or not we can ever know everything, if even how we describe or define what everything means, is that at least now we have the potential, like, we literally are no longer living in a world in which the sun could be paused in the sky for the whim of a particular racial identity.
Yes, like, yes, yes.
Wait, we know that things fundamentally work by certain laws, and we're just trying to figure all this out. And once we do, it makes sense, and there's a structure to it. We're like, oh, okay. Talk about freeing in that sense. Like, it's no longer a... You know, somebody may have mentioned, you know, caught vaguely in the chat about, you know, it's like, if you don't do such and such, I didn't go to church enough times, or I didn't say the rosary enough times, like, therefore this. And I'm like, even as I was a believer, there was a point where it was like, you know, the Calvinist idea of not knowing whether or not you're elect. You know, one of the sins behind that, you know, that theological frame is that you shouldn't ever declare yourself as knowing you're saved, because nobody really knows until they're in front of Jesus. I know, it's insane. Anxiety provoking.
That's a huge wager.
All the more, like, why isn't, like, literally every believer, why isn't everybody in a constant fit of anxiety attacks? Because you don't know. You can't know. Like, the very basis behind which you're trying to figure yourself out and everything else is a big old fat question mark. It's just, you know, this comes back to, what's the definition of faith? The hope in the things that are unseen. Well, I'd kind of like to see it. Thank you. Of course, yeah. Seeing is generically, you know, understood here. Ecological mess that you end up being in. And certainly, part of then this process of forming this new identity post-faith is to find a new equilibrium or a new way of relating oneself to your own self, but then other people, in a way that allows for uncertainty without the moral weight behind it. Like, we can sit here and go, I don't know, and not feel like there is something fundamentally wrong with us. Like, oh, okay, it's okay. And this is where, in part of the way of mitigating that is in this kind of value structure, is being able to look at, so this is a, you know, something else that Eric Fromm mentioned. It's like, value judgments are applicable to man in his interests only. Such value judgments, however, are not mere statements of likes and dislikes. They're not, you know, for man's properties are intrinsic to the species and thus common to all. Like, what we care about, like, imagine there is not a single person out there that doesn't at some level concern themselves with integrity, honesty, trust, family, and, you know, keep filling in the blanks. Even the complete and utter sociopath is somebody who at some level still is deeply concerned with truth, because they want to know what it is in order to twist around it. I mean, so there's still that point where it's like, there is a value there, even though we can utterly disagree with how they're trying to go about living their life. Exactly. Somebody just mentioned, you know, MLK Jr. I mean, there's a reason why, both one, he's almost universally admired and universally used by all sorts of different groups to buttress their own arguments, often contradicting one another. Because he was a deeply human person, just, and so as a consequence, he's like, I care about these things, but I care about them in a particular social context. How does this work out in practice? And he was figuring it out just like the rest of us, to varying degrees of success. And so when we look at, you know, that worldview, it's not just that it shapes the values, it shapes how you look at them, it develops how you think about yourself as a human being. It's an intrinsic part of how you relate to one another. And so always like to kind of get to the part of like, okay, well, what's some stuff that I can take home? Like, how do we go about, you know, trying to help out some of these things and put this into practice? And so one thing is really delving into values. Like, I know I kind of harp on this a bit. Part of it is just because that's what I fundamentally talk about all the time. But you can actually go through and I have actually a couple of worksheets that are free that are just how to explore what, you know, what matters to you. What are your values lists? And then you start exploring your worldviews. And by this, I mean more than just academic literature. I love the next philosophical text as much as the next person. But we are more than just a quote-unquote rational mind. We're a relational one. And so literally talk with different people, particularly ones that you disagree with. Read fiction. Yes, carte blanche. Go out, read the latest. I love the Dresden series. You know, read fiction, read, you know, what, do some Netflixing, you know, explore these different stories, how people relate to one another. Look at other cultures. This isn't about all cultures are the same. It has to do with various cultures have tried figuring out how to relate to the world in different ways. And the more that you broaden how your brain is taking things in, the more equipped you are to be flexible in responding to the inevitable uncertainties that is life. And that's really what we're about here, is flexibility, is to give us more awareness, more information to go, oh, I've done it this way before, and that kind of worked, but maybe I can try this variation, or I can try this one. And so then that comes into, you know, behavior. And it's like, literally try new things. Identify others, you know, who embody those values that you just deeply appreciate. How did they, what did they do to support them? And it's not necessarily about mimicking them per se, but it's about how did they go about it? Is there some version of what they did that I could bring into my own life? I don't know. And then, of course, asking yourself, because behavior is both an expression of what we care about and a way of trying to shape the world to have it make sense, then really we can ask ourselves, what am I doing? How is what I am doing shaping the world? What world am I making even in these little things? And this is a whole exploration of Kant's categorical imperative, for those who want to go into that. Another conversation. And then, of course, lastly, is honestly practicing mindfulness and meditation. I know mindfulness at times can get, you know, it's almost like it's everywhere. But the reality is our conscious experience is who we are. And the more we explore it, yeah, the more flexible we become in seeing what's out there.
You're almost, what you're suggesting is using your exploration to sort of like create a values library, in a sense. Like you can observe what works for you, what you like, what you don't like, what values you hold are important to you, what values are not, and kind of set them in a library. And like for me, there's books that I go back to time and time again that are important to me. They're meaning to me. I get a sense of fulfillment out of them. And then there's books that are like, I'm not even through the first two chapters and I've lost interest. And this is not something for me. But so it sounds like you're suggesting to kind of go explore and almost do grow your library of values. Is that, am I somewhat close?
Absolutely. In fact, when I work with clients or other, you know, it's, I often will describe it as, you know, in the value listing and the exploration of that is that you're essentially creating a thesaurus for your mind.
Thesaurus.
You're figuring out, yeah, all of these things that you resonate with and that you're going, well, this behavior was to support this, but it was also supporting this other thing. But when I did it, it got in the way of this other value that I appreciate. So now I can think back of, was it worth it? Was the give and take worth it? Is maybe I want to do a variation on it, and so on. And so that you're constantly exploring the best version of yourself that you at least currently know how to be. And of course, what is present is always collapsing into the next future. So we're in this constant, you know, evolutionary, you know, development process. And I was looking at, Stephen Batchelor, who I cannot recommend enough. He's just an amazing writer. But he wrote one book on being the Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. And he was looking at, and this is a guy who's serious bona fides. He's actually one of the main translators for the Dalai Lama. He was up there in the echelons of Buddhism. And he wrote how being in the world means that I am inextricably knit into the fabric of the fluid, indivisible, and contingent reality I share with others. There is no room for a disembodied mind or soul, however subtle, to float free from this condition, to contemplate it from a hypothetical Archimedean point outside. We are knit. You know, it's why I refer to my, you know, my private business as Life Weavings, because we are knit together. We're trying to figure out how we work in this weaving apparatus of our lives. How can we figure out and find this kind of golden thread to help us, you know, guide us through this? And eventually we figure out there's a whole bunch of them. And the more aware we are of the ones that we're following, the better.
That's beautiful. It's really cool. Very cool. But this has been a great discussion. Thank you so much. We have a couple of questions. Amai, you want to kick us off with the questions?
Yeah. So the first question that we have here is, where can I find a new identity after leaving religion? So where can I start if before I felt like everything of my life was related to religion and now I just don't have that anymore and I don't know what to base my values on. I just don't know where to base my life overall on. So do you have any advice for those people who are struggling in that area?
I hope I've provided at least a beginning process for being able to help out with that.
I heard you talk a lot about just picking up some books and also exploring. Having conversations with people you might not otherwise think to have conversations with.
This is recognizing that we don't just have one identity. You know, we can refer to this as like, you know, the hats that we wear. You know, all of us are, you know, have parents, we have friends, we're maybe student or former student or, a political group to, you know, atheist or agnostic, or, you know, it's like we have all of these labels that we hold ourselves to. And so part of the process of finding an identity is kind of honestly to realize that there is no singularity here, that we will shape ourselves and, you know, looking at our humanity as a kind of kaleidoscope. I'm totally going to date myself here. Yes. So yeah. I'm going to date myself here. So anybody grew up with those stories of those little things you put up to your eye and you've got all these colorful, you know, rocks or whatever at the end and you turn it.
You mean like a kaleidoscope?
Exactly, a kaleidoscope, yes. So
I love that.
So, I was so confused. And then when Eric said it, I was like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so we're going there, exactly. I already said it. But that's really what all of us are figuring out. Like we all have these set amount of stuff that we're rearranging, and even the subtlest of changes, we don't stop being us. We just have a slightly different facet of how things are showing up. And yet again, there's another avenue of exploration. And there's the trap, like where that fundamentalism brings, is that it tricks you into thinking that you're just this one thing. And you're not, thankfully. I mean, and I'm rather happy I'm not just one thing, because if I was just one thing, then the first time I ever lied, it would mean that I'm now a liar for all of eternity. Well, that would suck. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is difficult for me personally to, how do I say this? Like I get down on myself when I find that I've made a mistake in my thinking, or like in the past when I used some inappropriate slurs or made fun of people inappropriately, It's hard for me to like come back and say, hey, that was a different me, and I'm working to constantly become better. And so it's really hard for me to like not give myself that okay to grow and change, I guess, or be flawed in the past and still flawed currently.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And that's where, I mean, grace has a unfortunate historical connotation with some things, but I mean, there's a definite truth to holding us in a state of, hey, it's okay to allow for that period of growth and forgiveness and self-reflection.
That's great. Thank you. Someone else asks, I struggle with the inadequacy of any moral theory. Consequentialism makes sense in many contexts, but it's absurd in some contexts. Virtue ethics makes sense in many contexts, but it provides little useful guidance in many specific contexts. Deontology makes sense in some contexts, but it's absurd in others. Do you have any candidates for a comprehensive moral theory that would make sense everywhere, I guess?
I'll go back to, I actually quoted him earlier, Mark Johnson's Morality for Humans. And it's just a phenomenal naturalistic morality book. It really is. It really pulled together a couple of decades of study into a pretty comprehensive whole for me. And I would add, I mean, definitely there's some aspects of Eric Fromm. In fact, even The Big Picture by Sean Carroll has a fabulous way of a poetic naturalism is definitely something that I resonate a lot with. And one, that book is amazing, if you're into physics especially. But his explanation of it, you know, poetic naturalism, really is just, it's really, really nicely done.
Thank you. And then we have one last question, unless someone else send us another one. Eric, do you wanna get this one?
Is the relinquishment of a man-made concept of sin, is it core to establishing self-worth and defining a purpose once an individual kind of removes that supernatural thinking and also kind of removes the religious-based moral compass? So do you think that in order to kind of move forward, we have to drop the concept of sin and the religious-based moral compass? Or does that get us locked into a rigid structure?
Yeah, like I spoke about it previously about, you know, I've left all forms of fundamentalism behind. And as far as sin is concerned, honestly, I think it's probably one of the most pernicious, psychologically damaging ideas that has ever been created by human beings. In fact, I don't even know, I don't have the words to describe how awful that idea is, because it is, I come right up to referring to it as child abuse, even though that's not what I call it, because that has a whole lot of problems attached to that. But it's just, there's something deeply disturbing about an idea that says nothing you do matters, because fundamentally at a almost cellular level, you are inherently wrong. And not even wrong in the sense that you've done something wrong. You're wrong in the sense that you're antithetical to what is possibly to be right or good or any of it. Like, that level of disconnect is just so debilitating, and it's something that I wish, out of all the absurdities that people think, that really is the one that I wish I could just excise from creation. And I'm one that loves exploring ideas, but that's one I would love to just utterly remove.
Yeah, and like here in the world that we live in, if I do something wrong, if I quote unquote sin, then I have the ability to make good, either by doing some good deeds, or if I do something really bad, I can serve some time and, you know, or do some community service. And so in a sense, I can offset what wrong I've done by doing some good stuff. And in the religion I was raised or raised in, that was not the case. No matter how much good I did, there was no way to undo this original sin, or even any sin, let alone like no matter how big or small, unless I simply came pleading to the supernatural being and asked for forgiveness. Like I couldn't do good things to offset the mistakes I made or the bad things I did.
We have actually received a couple more questions, so I'm just going to quickly ask them. Yeah, sorry. So one of them is, could you accept fundamentalism if the intent and evidence was good?
Sure. I mean, it's one of those where, you know, it's so with caveats. the difficulty with fundamentalism is that fundamentalism is less an ideology and more of a characteristic of. So almost like a feeling base behind how one views the world. It's a characteristic of an ideology. It's not in itself. And fundamentalism, fundamentally, has to do with the idea of there is unquestionable ideas that there are sacrosanct ideas that are unassailable. And kind of an ideal, you know, I'm kind of an intellectual libertarian when it comes to that kind of thing. Everything should be capable of being questioned, and we should be free to ask ourselves anything. On one level, sure, evidence makes sense. I'm fully capable of saying, yeah, I was wrong, part or whole about anything. On the other hand, I'm not sure what evidence would necessarily count towards something that says now this is no longer capable of being questioned, like you've reached the pinnacle of this and none shall pass afterwards.
So much of what you said rang true, and very, very appreciative of your time. David, I've put a list of resources in that you provided for us into the chat, so thank you so much. And also, I'll put it again too, but if you want to find out more about, learn about more about David and some of the resources he has on his website, check it out.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.